Okay, so I'm going to remind you again of that teaching of the Buddhas. This is Sila, this is morality, ethics. This is Samadhi, meditative absorption. This is Prajna, wisdom. Rich is the fruit and great is the effect of Samadhi when it is based upon Sila. Rich is the fruit and great the effect of Prajna when it's based upon Samadhi. The mind, the heart, when developed through prajna, through wisdom, is thoroughly liberated from the taints, namely the taint of sense desire, the taint of becoming, and the taint of ignorance. So this is the Buddha speaking on his last great tour. He gave this teaching in most of the places he stayed on that last great tour. And the text, whenever he gives this particular teaching, the text says that describes this, calls this a comprehensive Dharma discourse, a comprehensive teaching on the Dharma. Probably he expounded what morality was, he expanded what morality was, what meditative concentration was, what wisdom was. He filled it out in some detail. And it's very interesting that the Buddha didn't mind repeating the same teaching again and again. He didn't mind doing that. Didn't worry if people thought that, it's that same teaching again. He didn't care about that. Didn't mind going over the basics, so to speak, again and again and yet again. We live in a world which is so sort of obsessed with the new. Or not the real new. I mean, there's very little actually that's genuinely new, that's sort of genuinely original. We live in a world where there's so much sort of novelty and fashion. And this can actually affect the whole way we approach the Dharma in the spiritual life. People often want new teachings, you know, entertainment. And you sort of see people sometimes kind of moving around the so-called sort of spiritual scene, obsessed with novelty and never really getting into anything. And people especially want higher teachings, the special meditation that really will get you quickly to enlightenment, you know, there and then. And of course, after a while they get a bit bored with that and go on to the next special teaching. And unfortunately there are teachers around too who do talk like this, you know, this is the special quick path, and so on and so forth. And it's very interesting, having been in the FWBO for over 30 years, I've seen so many fashions sweep through our Buddhist movement, so many things that promise so much, people kind of bringing in, not sort of saying, you know, there have been also developments, very interesting developments at times, but there's also been sort of fashions of swept through which haven't left us really any the wiser. And what really sticks, what's really made lasting contributions to our Sangha, to our movement, has been teachings and practices that have grown out of people's actual engagement and deepening engagement with these teachings on ethics, meditation and wisdom. They're the things that have really stuck and have really brought in something really fresh spiritually. Our teacher Sangharakshita once famously said, "There are no higher teachings, there are only deeper understandings. There are no higher teachings, there are only deeper understandings." So we need to engage, thoroughly engage with the trainings in ethics, meditation and wisdom, and look at our life each day in these terms. You know, so we need to be looking at our life. You know, we're moving towards the end of the retreat, so we need to start reflecting a bit on what we're going to be doing. So each day, when you're back home, well, look at your day in terms of ethics. You know, what's the state of my practice of the five precepts? You know, how can I do this better each day? Practice meditation every day, even if it's just for 20 minutes, even if it's just for 10 minutes. Try to do longer if you can, but meditate every day. Do some kind of Dharma study and reflection. So in other words, keep the wisdom teachings going. Just something. Read, you know, a verse of the Dhammapada every day and reflect on it. Just, you know, you just little by little build up. It's much better to have a little regularly than nothing and then a sort of binge of Dharma and then have a great reaction to it. No, a little regularly and then go on retreat and have a Dharma binge.
Yeah.
It's okay to have Dharma binges, but do it in the context of regular little by little practice. And in the end, the result of this will be liberation. It will be vimukti, vimoksha, as it's called. These are the terms, vimoksha, vimukti, which can be translated as liberation, emancipation, release, freedom even. And this term, liberation, vimoksha, is a very important term in Buddhism, and it's very, very rich in meaning. There are sort of multiple meanings to it. On one occasion, the Buddha gave a great discourse on his teaching, on the Dharma. And he likened the Dharma to the great and mighty ocean. You know, saying that the Dharma is as vast and as mysterious and wonderful as the great ocean. And he picked out in particular 8 strange and wonderful qualities of this Dharma ocean. And one of these referred to the taste of the ocean. Wherever you go in the ocean, wherever you go in the sea, it has one taste. It always has the taste of salt, wherever you go. In the same way, the Dharma has one taste. The taste, he says, of liberation, of freedom, of emancipation. Whatever the teaching, whatever the practice, when you have a direct experience of that teaching, of that practice, it will taste of freedom. It will have the direct experience of freedom and liberation, a sense of freeing up, of becoming liberated. That's the taste of Buddhist practice. You could even see it as a sort of criteria for Buddhist practice. Do you feel freer? Are you having an increasing sense of freedom, of liberation, through your training in ethics, meditation, and wisdom? But then, of course, we have to reflect a little. What precisely do we mean by freedom? What do we mean by liberation? It seems so straightforward, doesn't it? Yeah, you know, Buddhism's about having that taste of freedom. But actually, is it so straightforward? Because freedom is one of those values which perhaps we take for granted and we think we all know what it means. But maybe we mean different things by it. We think that perhaps that Buddhism's notion of freedom is the same as the notion of freedom that we have. And of course, our notions of freedom are very heavily conditioned by the society into which we're brought up, by our conditioning, our psychology. We probably mean different things by freedom. There's a very famous poem by John Milton, great English poet. Some would say the greatest English poet. It's a sonnet called On the New Forces of Conscience. On the New Forces of Conscience. And it was a sonnet written really with great disappointment, looking as he contemplated the effects of the Civil War, which he had great faith in, the English Revolution, and seeing the way the Commonwealth was going. And the famous line that Milton has in this sonnet is, "License they mean when liberty they cry. License they mean when liberty they cry." Milton's notion of liberty, of freedom, of emancipation, was not license. You know, not following every whim and fancy, every desire, every craving, regardless of its effect on self and other. That wasn't his notion of freedom and liberation. His notion of freedom and liberation was deeply moral, deeply ethical, involving great responsibility for the nation, for the Commonwealth. It's a bit of a digression, but not really. We can have notions of freedom and liberation, which can mean that we have a right, a God-given right, so we don't believe in God, a right to have whatever we want, whenever we want it, to do whatever we like, whenever we feel like it, regardless of consequences, regardless of the effect, the long-term effect on ourselves and others. This is a very, very deep notion of freedom, I think, and generated, I think, by our capitalist market-driven world. I think we're very, very affected by that, by this market-driven world. There's so much emphasis on the consumer. I mean, it's appalling. I remember debates about the health service and freedom to choose. I mean, I don't want to choose which hospital to go to. You know, I don't want that kind of freedom. That's confusing. That is actually tyranny. And this is sort of presented as, you know, as it's some wonderful liberation. Well, it's not. It's actually creating immense confusion and oppression. The oppression of choice. It's dreadful. Anyway, So we have all these... The point I'm trying to make is that we have all these views of freedom. And that actually we might end up with a notion of freedom which causes restriction and limitation for ourselves and other people. And enslavement. Even notions of freedom that might involve enslavement of others. You know, this is some of the things that we can end up with. So these, I know, are big questions and big problems that you know, involves sort of endless debate, and too big really to go into here. I just wanted to raise them, just to sort of raise the question of what do we mean and understand by freedom. Let's instead just look at the Buddhist notions of freedom, of liberation, the Buddhist vision of liberation. Perhaps if we can understand that and develop a feeling for that, then we might have a perspective on the whole question of freedom in the modern world. In the quotation from the Buddha says this: the mind, the heart, the citta, as it's called in the original language, when developed through prajna, through wisdom, is thoroughly liberated, is completely free, emancipated from the enslavement of the taints, namely the taint of craving for sense experience, the taint of becoming, or rather fixed being, and the taint of ignorance, of unknowing. So thoroughly liberated, vimoksha. And this thorough liberation, this complete liberation and freedom, is synonymous with nirvana, with enlightenment itself. So freedom, liberation in the highest sense, is the same as enlightenment. It's the language of freedom and liberation brings out this particular quality, this particular aspect of enlightenment. In enlightenment, there is no sense of constriction or cramping or limitation or enslavement at all. The state of enlightenment is utterly open-ended, as if you're completely free to move in boundless space. There's complete liberation. Even if you were locked up and held down, even if your body was limiting you physically, your consciousness would feel no liberation at all, no enslavement at all. It would be a sense of complete open-ended expansion. This can never be taken away when you gain enlightenment, whatever's being done to you. Remember what I said about the Buddha's yesterday, about the Buddha's illness. Okay, you can say physically there's a limitation, but mentally, spiritually, none at all. No limitation at all. So all this opens up, this liberation, because of the effect on our minds of prajna, of wisdom. The effect on our minds of seeing things as they really are. When you see reality as it is, nakedly, stripped of all coverings, of all veils, the avaranas, as they're traditionally called, the effect is one of complete freedom, a complete liberation from the taints, as the translator has it, the taints. This word taints is a translation of the Pali ashrava in Sanskrit. And here it's translated as taints, but there's a bit more to it than that, actually. Asava is a very ancient term. And originally, the word asava seems to have been some sort of poisonous discharge from a tree. a poisonous discharge from a tree. So some of the early translators translates it as canker. You know, if you see a tree and it's got some sort of poisonous discharge which is sort of forming a sort of canker around it, sort of a growth on a tree. Well, that would be an arsava in ancient India. So it's also been translated as the poisonous fluxes. The poisonous fluxes. There's like a poisonous discharge in our system. It's also been translated as outflows or biases. Perhaps the best translation, though, is flood. A flood. There are these floods in our being, these sort of poisonous floods, these deep forces, deep energies even, deep habits that hold us down, that hold us back, these currents within our being that bind us, that keep us bound. And the term asava is synonymous with other words, which again sort of suggest limitation, like fetter. Fetter is another kind of flood, and klesha, defilement, is another kind of thing that limits us. So Buddhism is very rich, actually, in describing these things which limit us and restrict us. So let's look at in terms of these asavas. Look at this in terms of the floods, the three great floods in our being that keep us sweeping us away from freedom. We make some progress. We feel as though we're expanding, freeing up, perhaps especially on retreat, perhaps especially when the sun's shining. And then we're swept away. Our practice, something happens and old habits seem to sort of sweep us away. Perhaps when we go back home, especially when the clouds gather kind of inside and outside, we're swept away. The current seems to bring us back to the kind of prison that we've been in before. In the early days of the FWO, Sangharakshita gave a series of talks on the higher evolution of the individual, very good series of talks, and he talks about the point of no return, and here he talks about the gravitational pull. It was the time when people were going to the moon and things like that, so there was a lot of talk about gravity and getting out of the gravitational pull of the earth. Well, there's also the gravitational pull of the conditioned, the gravitational pull of samsara, the gravitational pull of the world. Well, the asavas are another way of talking about the gravitational pull. And it's, you know, pulling us back to an unfree state. That's why it's so hard sometimes. You know, we make an effort in ethics, meditation and wisdom, but there's a sort of force of gravity that keeps pulling us back to our old habits. Well, these are the asavas. There does come a point, though, where we move into a different kind of gravitational field, where it's the pull of the unconditioned, the pull of nirvana, and to that wide open freedom of enlightenment. That's called stream entry in old Buddhist tradition, where you enter the flood, the stream, that just goes to nirvana. So you're not going to be pulled back to the flood of the conditioned. But we're going to look at these three floods that keep us bound. So, first of all, the flood of sense experience, of the flood of craving for sense experience, kamasava. This very deep flood that keeps us tied to desire for sense experience. Now, you might be thinking from this that the Buddha and Buddhism has a thoroughly negative view of sense experience. Has a real down on the senses, that the flesh is bad and all that sort of thing. And, you know, we import perhaps, you know, other, you know, views from other religions that sense experience is bad and terrible. But that actually wouldn't be true. And you need to keep that in mind whenever you're looking at Buddhist texts that describe this. You know, you get weird questions, you know, when you talk like this. Well, is it okay to enjoy a sunset? Or is it okay to enjoy a beautiful view? Or is it wrong to enjoy art and music and poetry? And, is it wrong to enjoy friendship? And you know, some Buddhists you might meet might have that view, and that they think of nirvana as a sort of transcendental abstraction, you know, and that following the path is, you know, an increasing sort of alienation from your experience, and just getting, I talked about it yesterday, becoming more of a sort of zombie. But it's not like that. It's really not like that. And if you're doing that, you're on the wrong path, and you've got to put a stop to it. We find the Buddha himself really appreciating sense experience, really appreciating it, fully appreciating it, if you like. On one occasion, in fact, he was asked a question: if you reach a liberation, the liberation called the beautiful, there's a liberated state called the beautiful, does that mean you see everything as ugly? And the Buddha said, no, say not so. A man who's attained the liberation called the beautiful knows what beauty really is. You know, very, very wonderful answer, and well worth reflecting on. And we know the Buddha himself rejoiced in the beauty of nature. Lovely passage at the end of his life where he just turns to Ananda and he just rejoices in these tree shrines of the city of Vaishali. He says, lovely is this shrine, lovely is that shrine, these sacred groves of trees, which would have been very beautiful, peaceful places where the Buddha liked to stay. And he just stayed, he just rejoiced in them. Just rejoiced in them. There's even a time where a celestial musician, you have these in the Buddhist texts, a kind of transcendental guitarist, you know, veena player or something like that, is sort of, you know, getting off on one and singing a love song to some sort of nymph. And he's even breaking into poetry and likening his longing and love for this beautiful nymph for the longing of somebody to attain nirvana. And the Buddha says, well, son, well, son, well, son, well said. You know, so he could even enjoy a love song. And in all of the Buddhist tradition, wherever you go, you find this wonderful, you know, poetry, really expressive of the love of nature, the beauty of nature, and so on. And you find you know, Buddhist traditions of Buddhist poetry and painting. So all over the Buddhist world, there's this love, there's this appreciation of beauty experienced through the senses. It's actually not really the senses and sense experience that is a problem, actually. What ensnares us is our craving for it, our attachment to it, especially the more gross forms of sense experience that get caught up with all sorts of negative emotions of and all sorts of complexities, and which bind us and hold us down. The problem is that we just get very dependent on certain forms of sense experience. It becomes a sort of refuge for us and a source of security, and we can't do without it. And as I said, it's often rather gross, involving unskillful responses. And when it's taken away, we just feel very deprived and lost and suffer a lot and even get angry and get into a mess. You sort of see this when somebody's relationship ends and they don't want it to end. You know, they're all over the shop. You know, they're all over the place, a terrible state. It's like their whole world has fallen apart because they're completely overinvested in the sense experience of this relationship. So you know, that's the problem, our craving and attachment. And we need to reflect, well, you know, it is going to get taken away. Sense experience, all sense experience will get taken away. You know, in the experience of death. It's why death is so frightening, because we invest so much in gross sense experience. And this is why meditation can be so difficult for us and so demanding, because what meditation is doing, we're moving away, we're moving beyond purely sense-based experience. You know, first of all, we have a much more subtle experiences of the senses. You notice this, don't you? That it becomes more subtle, the breath becomes more subtle and your engagement with it is more subtle. It's not like how you experience the breath, you know, as you're walking around and so on. And well, that starts to even that starts to get very refined, and you start opening up to something even beyond sense experience as we ordinarily know it. Sometimes people can experience a very, very deep sort of primal fear when they meditate, because they're moving beyond sense experience. Something is opening up beyond the known and the sensed. We're opening up to higher and deeper consciousness, and that can be, you know, quite frightening. But we've got to sort of sit with that and live with that and get used to it, if you like. Sometimes you find you know, this wonderful sort of opening up happening after a puja. You know, you've had a very full day of meditation and study and all the rest of it, and then, you know, do a lovely puja, and at the end you sit in that wonderful stillness, that deep silence, you know, having a sort of sense of consciousness really sort of opening up. And then what happens afterwards? Well, you have to go on a raid to the toast or the cereal packet. You know, we're kind of moving out, we're opening up, and yeah, but you just got to go back to sense experience. You know, can't take this. You know, I can't take this. I'm opening up too much. Stuff it down. You know, the energy's too much. Just kind of put the lid on. Anything but experience that freedom. And the weird thing is, the really weird thing is, of course, that state of opening up is so much more pleasurable than eating. But we can't stand it. You know, we just want to get back to what's familiar and what we're used to. So anyway, we need to learn to do a few things if we're going to move, you know, get rid of this flood of desire for sense experience, if we're going to experience the freedom beyond it. I talked a bit about this yesterday. I think one of the best practices here is moving from appropriation to appreciation. Moving from the having and getting and using mode to the, as it were, useless, appreciative mode of being. You know, our sense experience is so often caught up with craving and grasping and having, which means we're not free. You know, if we're really into craving and grasping, that means that we're defining ourselves as the person who has to have and use all these things. So we need to move to the appreciative mode, learning to see and hear and smell and taste and touch without having to possess and own. This is quite a practice. You know, we need to learn to look at things. Just learn to look at nature without having to take a photo of it. You know, without having to sort of, oh, there's a sunset, click. You know, oh, I've got the sunset, I can show it to my friends. Fantastic, I'm the person who takes pictures of wonderful sunsets. How about just looking at that sunset? Or that tree, or that scene? You know, or, oh, got to have the binoculars, got to see what bird it is so I can, you know, tell everybody what sort of bird it is. No, don't do that. Look at the beautiful bird. It's just a wonderful living being. Just enjoy that. Watch the play of light on leaves. Enjoy and let it go. Move on. And I mentioned yesterday how wonderful the arts are here as a way of sort of training in this. You know, whenever I go to an art gallery, even if it's in busy London, you know, and I really look, rather than going around, oh, so I can tell everybody, oh, I looked at a Rembrandt the other day, isn't that fantastic? I'm a good person, I looked at Rembrandt. But rather than doing that, really looking, you go out and you start seeing people differently. You do. You start looking as if through the artist's eyes. You know, that's why the great poets are so important. You know, you really read a great poet, you're tuning into that quality of awareness, and you actually start looking at things differently. And of course, if you practice these things, if you ever, you know, done some drawing and you really try to draw what's there, you know, you look at everything in a different way. You know, you enter into experience more fully, but you're not trying to own it and possess it. You're sort of dissolving self and other when you're doing that. And I mentioned yesterday how important the metta bhavana is in this. You know, in fact, all meditation, in moving from the appropriative to the appreciative. So these are just a few ways that we can free ourselves from the flood of craving for sense experience. Free ourselves from enslavement to sense experience. It's why retreat is so important, and the whole sort of simplicity of retreat. It's so fantastic for freeing ourselves from this enslavement to the flood of sense experience and being defined by it. You know, if you were to tell somebody, you know, say, well, what have you been doing for the last week? Well, I've been on a vegetarian diet, there's been no telly, no booze, no internet, no mobile phone, no shopping. Well, occasionally I went up the road and got an ice cream, but that was a lapse. And I've been spending quite a bit of the day in silence and sitting on a cushion or a chair for, you know, quite a few hours in the day, not doing anything, looking at the breath, developing love for people. Some people would think you were insane. You were completely, what, no tip, what, no drink, what, no internet, no, what? You know, weren't you bored? And you said, no, it was a fantastically rich experience. You know, incredibly rich time. You know, so it's worth reflecting on that, actually, when you go away. Reflect on the richness and simplicity of a retreat. And, you know, we don't have to have all the things that we usually have for that richness. And because we're beginning to free ourselves from that flood, that asava of sense experience. Okay, let's go to the second of the asavas. This is freeing ourselves. Wisdom liberates us from bhavasava. The flood towards becoming. Or rather, here, bhava means more like fixed being, habitual being. It's really the flood that makes us think of ourselves. I am this. This is the way things are. It's always like this. I want to say that in a Yorkshire accent for some reason. I was having a conversation with a Yorkshireman the other day, but you could just as easily say it in any accent you like. This is what I am. This is the way the world is. I am this, nothing can change. This is the kind of verbal manifestation of bhavasava. We get very involved in sense experience, material experience, because it's tied up with a fixed and established notion of what we are, of what we're like, and what the world is supposed to be. We sort of hold very, very deep views of who we are and what the world is. We hold sort of deep myths, if you like, deep stories about who we are, what we are, what the world is, how things are supposed to be. It's not just, it will be reflected in ideas and views and opinions, but it's held at a very, very deep level indeed. And we can get very, very stirred up, very threatened indeed when those myths and stories start to break up or start to get threatened in any way. People can actually get very stirred up through meditation, through Buddhist practice, because actually awareness is touching those deep myths, those deep stories, that deep flood of being in a certain way. Because the deep stories are being exposed, yes, by the light of the Dharma, the light of awareness. And this is why we place so much emphasis on the meditations concerned with integration and positive emotion. Mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, are just so important, because actually you will stir yourself up through those practices, but you're also providing yourself with a whole context to make sense of the of that stirring up. You've got a ground, if you like, a context which can absorb the change. We have, Sangha Rakshita has given our own order, a system of meditation. There's an unfolding system and sequence of practices. You're particularly getting familiar, most of you, with the first two of these, the mindfulness of breathing, which is particularly concerned with integration, and the metta-bhavana, which is particularly concerned with positive emotion. They're the first two great stages, integration and positive emotion. But then there's a third stage, which is called the stage of spiritual death, the great death, the spiritual death. The third great stage in our system of practice is when we spiritually die, when we dissolve this fixed idea of ourselves, our fixed being. And in our order, we practice meditations that involve reflection upon the fact that we don't in fact have a fixed and separate and unchanging self. And actually, with these practices, we only teach as people prepare for ordination on their ordination retreat. We see ordination as a sort of stage of spiritual death. Obviously, you've got to keep up this reflection, these meditations, which are to do with dissolving your fixed sense of yourself and world after you're ordained. And we only give these meditations to people who are seriously spiritually committed. If you prepare properly, these meditations are not as frightening or as bleak as they might sound. I mean, it might sound, crikey, spiritual death. That sounds a bit heavy. But actually, when you prepare properly for these meditations and you've also studied the Buddha's teaching well, what actually happens is that you can have experiences of a wonderful feeling, a very, very deep relaxation. This deep letting go and opening up to something that you can't really name and describe. That's what spiritual death is really all about. You're opening up to the unlimited, to sort of wide open space and wide open awareness. And you have a tremendous sense of freedom and liberation from all the fixed ideas and views you have of yourself and your world. And these meditations are also a preparation for actual death. In Buddhist tradition, death is regarded, in fact, as a great opportunity. Death is regarded as a wonderful opening when reality in its nakedness just shines forth like blinding white light. It just flashes forth, and it's a white light, a luminosity beyond self and other, and it just flashes forth at the time of death. All ground vanishes whatsoever. Of course, if you're not prepared, you can't take it in. And you shrink back. You shrink back to old habits, to that flood of fixed being, to that bhavasava. But if you're prepared, you embrace it. And death itself is a liberation. Sangharakshita has said, death is a state of enforced meditation. Death is a state of enforced meditation, because at the time of death, all sense experience is taken away, and your ordinary mind is taken away, the ground is taken away, and everything opens. Well, that's what meditation is like. And in fact, all meditation, not just these meditations that are to do with reflection on no fit self, all meditations are a preparation for death, because you're learning to go beyond sense experience and you're learning to go beyond the fixed state of being associated with sense experience. In meditation, you're learning to open up to the vastness and to let go of identifying with a limited self. Okay. So let's go now to avijjāsava, the flood of the taint of ignorance. Avijja in Pali, avidya in Sanskrit. So it's usually translated as ignorance, but it's more like anti-knowledge, anti-wisdom, anti-awareness. There's a great sort of force in us that does not want to see, that does not want to know. Ignorance in Buddhism isn't just Well, I didn't know. There's something in us that doesn't want to know, doesn't want to see, does not want to be aware. There's some, means that something in us is actually aware, is actually tuned up to reality. But there's this big force that just doesn't want to know anything about it. We blind ourselves to reality. And so we're bound. We're not free. And of course, it's the truth that will set you free in the famous saying. And it's very hard to see the way things are. It's hard to see because of this flood towards not seeing, towards ignorance that's within us. And because we live very often in an environment that just discourages seeing. You know, there's a whole world that sort of, you know, basically is conspiring for us not to see. We don't see. One of the big things that we're not seeing is the fact that we have the potentiality to be Buddhas. That's the thing that we're really not seeing. That's the thing that we're really ignorant of. That there's something in us that actually can gain complete liberation, that can become the embodiment of wisdom and compassion, that can become enlightened. We don't see that we are, in fact, rather than being a fixed being, that we are actually becoming, that we're ever changing. And because we're ever changing, and because life is ever changing, we have the potential to be Buddhas. As the great Dogen, the great Zen master, said, impermanence is Buddha nature. Impermanence is nothing other than the potential for Buddhahood. So all the time we're conspiring with ourselves not to see our potential for enlightenment, our potential for liberation. Ignorance is incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. And we really underestimate it. In Buddhist tradition, it's presented as a blind man with a stick. But if you look at the depictions of the blind man, he's got this very willful set jaw. You know, it's not just blind and helpless, but it's this willed blindness. Somebody has also suggested, but it's not so much a blind man, but a man who's tied a blindfold round his head. He's done that. And going along willfully, and willfully not taking it off. And just going along, blundering along, creating suffering. There's that amazing painting by Bruegel of three blind men, you know, kind of chained to each other, going along, you know, just causing suffering to themselves and other people. And they got really greedy, nasty faces. Well, that's us. It's not the whole story. There's also a Buddha in there. In us, but you know, we need to kind of wise up to our blindness and all the unskillful habits, all the sort of enslavement that goes on out of that blindness. It's very ugly ignorance, very, very ugly. It's bound up with craving and aversion. So we need, especially that sort of focusing on the negative, and I don't want to dwell on that. We actually need really a vision of what we can become, an alternative. That's what we need to dwell on, the alternative to these visions of blind men. We also need a vision of liberation. And I mentioned earlier our system of meditation practice in our order. Spiritual death, the stage of spiritual death, is not the last word. After the stage of spiritual death, there's the stage of spiritual rebirth. And the stage of spiritual rebirth is represented by meditations on archetypal forms of the Buddha. Archetypal forms of the Buddha. You know, in our shrine room, we've got all those paintings of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Well, these are some of the archetypal forms on which we meditate after we're ordained. At the time of ordination, you're not just taught a meditation on how to see through your fixed self, how to die spiritually. You're also taught meditations which represent your spiritual rebirth. You're initiated into practices which which involve these meditation on your spiritual potential, on what you can be, on what in a way you are when you undergo spiritual death, what is revealed when you die spiritually. And I'm going to describe one of these meditations. It's the meditation on the Buddha himself, the Buddha Shakyamuni. So what you do in this meditation is, first of all, imagine the vast space, clear blue sky in all directions, and try to imagine that you're sort of letting go of all your notions of a fixed self and world, and you're just sort of floating in this vast space. And then there emerges in front of you, gradually, you imagine a whole sort of scene. There's a great grassy plain stretching out in front of you into infinity, really. It's grass, it's beautiful grass, sprinkled with beautiful coloured flowers, and in the distance you can see sort of snow peaks. And then there emerges out of the grassy plain the great Bodhi tree, a wonderful silver trunk tree with these wonderful dark green glossy leaves flickering in the light. This is the Bodhi tree, the tree under which the Buddha gained enlightenment. And beneath that tree there appears a pile of kusa grass, a great pile of green grass. And on the grass you see a white sheet, a square sheet, just laid out. And then above that a golden lotus appears, just floating above it. And on that golden lotus you see the Buddha himself, like the Buddha on our shrine. Beautiful figure, the embodiment of wisdom and compassion, at the centre of a mass of golden light. And you meditate on that form, and then you see, coming from the heart of the Buddha, a stream of golden light, or sort of golden nectar, a bit like the I don't know if Vidyavadra had this in mind when he put the golden cloth coming from the vase from the shrine, but it's like a communication, a teaching from the Buddha coming to you, filling you with golden light. And along that beam of light you see letters, the letters of the Buddha's mantra, Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakyamuni Swaha, just streaming into you, and you feel all the qualities of the Buddha filling you, just filling you with that sound of that mantra which you're hearing. You're sort of hearing the whole of the cosmos saying that mantra, and you're being transformed from an ordinary being into an enlightened being. You're feeling that sense of freedom opening up, the freedom of being a Buddha. And after you've done this for a while, it just all sort of dissolves away. The mantra fades into silence, and the whole scene just gradually fades away into the blue sky. And even the blue sky, you just let go of that. You know, so you've got a whole sort of, you're meditating on the whole arising and passing away of things. Even this beautiful scene, this beautiful communication that you've had with the Buddha, very meaningful, even that fades away. And then you just sit. You sit in stillness and silence, just enjoying the freedom, enjoying all the sort of qualities effortlessly that have passed across. And a practice like this, of course, does many, many things. It's a very, very rich kind of practice, meditating like this. And you try to do it every day after you're ordained. But one of the great things it does, it really increases your confidence, your shraddha, as it's traditionally called, this faith in your spiritual potential. It really increases that, makes that very strong in you, makes you feel very joyful about that. It increases your sense of the spiritual ideal, of the Buddha, of enlightenment. It's a meditation on all the qualities of enlightenment: love, compassion, energy, freedom. And you feel much freer to dedicate your life to that spiritual ideal, and you want to live it more fully and more completely. So that's one way to free ourselves from the flood of ignorance. And because it's an image, it's working very deeply on those, you know, those deep stories, those deep myths that we carry within us. Images are very, very powerful. They go in very, very deeply. And that's why we have them. in Buddhist traditions, why we have images of enlightenment, so it can really go right into the depths of our being. In the end, really, the Buddhist path is about emerging into a state of unlimited freedom, a state of joyful and blissful creativity. And traditionally it's said this freedom isn't and can't be just for ourselves. If it's just for ourselves, it's not really freedom. It must result in love and compassion for others, for those who don't have such freedom, who don't enjoy such freedom. And the Buddha's example, and the example of all the great teachers from the Buddhist tradition, is that they just spent their life after their enlightenment moving freely to give their freedom to others. And you don't have to wait until you're enlightened. You know, any freedom that you experience on the path, if it really is a freedom, even if it's just a little bit of freedom, well, it must result in you moving out to others, in generosity, to help them in their path of freedom. I was talking to somebody yesterday who was telling me just about their experience of going to one of our Buddhist centres and how, you know, what a wonderful moment it was when he was related to in terms of his potential, how liberating it was, and how he wanted to kind of also transmit that experience and give that to others. Well, that's the sort of thing I mean. It's not the full freedom of enlightenment, but it's definitely the beginnings of that. So freedom isn't just about the end, it's also experienced at the beginnings of the path. And in fact, all Buddhist traditions say that our human life itself is a freedom, is a wonderful liberation. It's said, you know, if you attain a human life, and they call it an attainment, it means you're free of states of being where it's almost impossible to develop and grow spiritually, to activate the potential for Buddhahood. And not just the human state. You know, we enjoy a human state where we're actually free to practice. We're free to practice Buddhism. We could have been born in a country plagued by civil war, you know, where you wouldn't be free to get on with spiritual practice, or where Buddhist practice is suppressed or regarded as illegal. There are some countries in the world where if you were a Buddhist, you could be in real trouble. I mean, I've heard of Buddhists in Iran who have to practice in complete privacy, and you know, they can't let it be known that that's what they're doing. Well, we're not in that. We're not like that. We're free to go on retreat. We also have the time and leisure to do it. I know we probably all feel, well, I don't have enough time and leisure, but you know, some people have no leisure. You know, I know people in India who can't get on retreat. They don't have the money to go on retreat. Love to go on retreat. They can't. They don't have the leisure, the wealth to do that. So we have enormous freedoms, actually. We really do have enormous freedoms. So the important thing is not to waste and squander those freedoms. Life is very short. The duration of our life is uncertain. So we need to make the most of what we have right now. As the great Dogen says, you are only alive right now. And in that moment, there is enormous freedom to make the most of what we have. Right now, we're free to live well and to live fully, and especially to grow towards enlightenment, to activate awareness and loving kindness. And we're also free to play a part in enriching the world and giving freedom to others. So we have that freedom. You know, sometimes I think it's worth saying, you know, that you know, on these retreats, I mean, we don't mind at the end of them if people don't take up Buddhist practice. You know, we're not we don't get uptight if people aren't interested in Buddhism. But what's really important is that people really make the most of their life. Really make the most of their life in a way that's really going to increase, you know, their creativity and the riches of the world. That's the most important thing to do. We have that freedom. We have that potential. I'm going to end with a poem by Sangharakshita, which is really, I think, a poem about the desire to be free. He wrote it in the very early days of our Sangha. And I think it was very much in a mood, this desire, this longing, you know, for spiritual liberation, for the liberation of enlightenment. So it's called I Want to Break Out. I want to break out. Batter down the door. Go tramping black heather all day on the windy moor. And at night in hayloft or under hedge, find a companion suited to my mind. I want to break through, shatter time and space, cut up the void with a knife, pitch the stars from their place, nor shrink back when, lidded with darkness, the eye of reality opens and blinds me, blue as the sky.